for me growing up in Virginia in the South, I don't know if there was any particular moment in which I had an epiphany. And I realized one day that I was a Negro. We lived in a very rural area outside of Essex County, or in Essex County, outside of the main town of Tappahannock, which is where we grew up. And because we were in our own little isolated, insulated kind of community, you know, we had our own, we were, many of the folk who lived there were self-sufficient farmers, and my grandfather owned a sawmill, then he employed about 25, 30 men at one time. He owned it with his brother. And you know, our community was more or less self-sufficient. I mean, we had occasional contact with the larger white world outside. But, you know, I didn't think that I was deprived. I had a good childhood. And when I started in school, I think, you know, from the very beginning, you know, when I, on the bus that I rode to school every day, when we passed this other school and we saw these white children outside playing, then I think at that point you realize that, well, there's a different world out there somewhere. No, clearly for me, my first experience or first coming of age, so to speak, was positive. It had always been positive. I remember in 68, 69, the local NAACP in Essex County, along with another organization called the Civic League. That was when it was, this was during the period of freedom of choice. And there were several African-American leaders from the community, from the town, who went door-to-door to black households, trying to get the parents to agree to send their children to the white school under the new freedom of choice mandate that had just come down. And my parents were living in D.C. at the time. My grandmother raised me. And so when these people came to my grandmother's house, my grandfather always was in the kitchen. He never got involved in this kind of stuff. He let my grandmother handle matters. And so when there was a delegation of about two or three, as I recall, one of whom was my fifth grade teacher, when they came to the house that evening and they said, you know, we'd like for you to think about sending Tony, as they call me, to the white school. And my grandmother looked at them and she said, well, what do you think he'll learn in the white school that he's not learning where he is? And they were sort of taken aback. She says, you know, integration, as far as I see it up to this point, has been a burden that has been borne by black people. And when the schools are fully integrated the way they should be, and when all of the resources are brought to bear to make these things happen, then he won't have to move because the school where he is will be integrated. And she says, no, I'm not going to move him. And she didn't. And I was in the fifth grade. And some years later, a couple years later, in the seventh grade, that was when I first had white classmates, because by that time, freedom of choice had been overturned in the Green versus New Kent County, and that was the beginning of school pairing and busing and those kinds of things. And, you know, looking back, you know, I really didn't think much about it at the time that my grandmother confronted these people, but looking back at that experience some years later, I burst with pride when I think about her defiance and how concerned she was for me and my well-being. And I thought about it more than one occasion, and never have I been prouder of her and of being black than at that moment.
I think that I was always aware that I was not white. I didn't think that that was a particular problem. I grew up in a family in which my father and I especially were very close. He doted on me and I doted on him. I remember being very angry with my mother at a very early age because she married him. That meant I couldn't. But so, you know, I was me, and that was that. I felt race as a burden first, and this may surprise you, while I was in college. As you might guess, growing up in South Carolina, I never attended desegregated schools. I graduated from high school. I left high school before the schools in South Carolina started to desegregate. So as a student at Fisk, I was, again, very comfortable. At the time, I knew a very great deal about computers. As a part of the training class, which was also, I learned later, an experiment, the first time they had 25% of their incoming professionals in integrated classes, we had a number of classes taught by whiz kid white guys, frankly. I remember one in particular was a Harvard MBA, and he would clutch his pipe tightly between his teeth, 28 years old, wise in all ways of the world, and he'd walk up and down, he'd mutter about Cormage libraries. I said, what the heck is he talking about? And then all of a sudden, I realized not only did I know exactly what he was talking about, but I was as good, if not better, than most other people in that room. I said, aha, I can do this. And that sustained me, and from that point forward, it's been, aha, I can do this. At times, I'm not going to say it's always been easy. At times, it's taken a great deal of effort. And I've been frustrated at my own inability to grasp concepts that I've now presented in classrooms for more than 36, maybe 37 years. But the sense that I could do it was, for me, the important moment. That was the point at which I realized, at least, that race was irrelevant. It really was about not the package, but the ability.
If I could, I'd like to add one other thing to my earlier comment. I think it's impossible for any black person my age, older, to live and grow up in the South and not have some defining moments about race and identity. And one in particular that has always sort of lingered with me happened on April 5th, 1968. It was the day after King's assassination. And I went to school. At that time, the school was all black. And I went to my school on that morning, and there was no official schoolwork that day. We sang civil rights songs. The teachers that I had never saw cry before, and all black, all staff, everyone was black. And students were crying, and it was quite a moving experience, and I think all of us, think it's fair to say, were emotionally devastated. And as I passed the white school going home that afternoon, I wondered what they did that day. I've always wondered what they did in class that day.
Another time, I neglected to take into account that we have to move one panel from this panel till tomorrow. So we actually have more time than I thought we had. Feel free if there are any other questions.
I'd like to hear what Patrice has to say about my first experience, too.
Interesting. I am truly a brown baby as well. I was born in Fort Wayne, Indiana, in an industrial community in northwestern Indiana, because my relatives had migrated from Alabama and Mississippi, because Fort Wayne at that time was a tremendous industrial hub, many factories. And for people who wanted the better opportunity but maybe didn't want to go to Chicago or Pittsburgh or Gary, Fort Wayne was a very good compromise in terms of its size, about 120,000 people. And it was the hub in that part of the state for a large agricultural community. But I, too, lived in the black community, which was very much in the center of town. Attended black churches, remember black businesses that were there. But my school was desegregated. So although I was born as a brown baby, I have literally attended desegregated schools all of my life. And it's been an incredible conversations with colleagues and peers in different parts of the country to see how brown impacted people in different places. Nevertheless, I would say, I was sitting thinking when you asked them, I think the first time I realized something was different when I was in first grade. And about a year ago, my mother, in cleaning out things at home, found a picture of my first grade class. And I always envisioned my first grade class to have been black and white. Interestingly, in looking at the picture, it was desegregated, but it was more black than white. So I would say of 25 children in the class, probably 17 were black and 8 were white. So, and then thinking about it, the children who were there were the children who couldn't flee. They were the children whose parents couldn't leave to go to other schools and communities. And so I think my initial moment that something was different was Jody. Jody was blonde. Jody had Shirley Temple curls. She was very precocious. And I remember being in class and having a very good kindergarten experience, but I went into first grade, and I remember when I would raise my hand and Jody would raise her hand, Jody always got called on. And it was something that bothered me, and I went home and talked to my mother about it, and she said, well, I know you're talkative. You know, she said, but you just hang in there. And she said, you just, you know, keep on raising your hand. And so over a period of time, I did. But that was the first time that I realized, and I think back on it now as an educator who teaches teachers how to teach in classes, that what Brown wanted was for all of us to be together. But nevertheless, we were physically in the same classroom, sitting in seats next to one another. And I felt that there was a difference in the way that Jody was being treated and I was being treated. That said, subsequently, we moved to Philadelphia. And so much of my formative education was in Philadelphia. And I would say, if anybody ever had an opportunity to live Dr. King's dream in education, it was in the incredible 10 years that I spent in Philadelphia. That my parents were educational advocates and very involved in the community. And I lived in an integrated neighborhood. And it was really a sense of where there were people in our community who, when blockbusting was coming, a group of people got together and said, we're not going to have this. The West Mount Airy Neighbors was formed almost 50 years ago, and it was really seeing black, white, Italian, you know, everyone coming together doing that. And so then in some ways, my formative experiences were sheltered, but in a different kind of way. So I had a much more holistic, global view and didn't see the barriers, and it was very fluid. And issues of human rights and global issues and things were very much about what we talked about in high school. But then I went to college. And so my college experience then, I was at Northwestern University in the early 70s, and then that's where it became the black table, the black dorm. There was very much that physical separation, and my immediate response was, why would I have to choose? Because I'd had this high school experience where there had been such a diversity of people and ideas and culture and thinking, and you literally sought out people who disagreed with you because it was a great opportunity for you to, you know, really exchange and really test yourself. And so at that moment in time, then that's when I think it was really the epiphany, because again, people were very much polarized in choosing sides, that you were either one way or the other. And so my college experience was really rich in helping me work through, you know, a lot of that. So in some ways, I think mine was somewhat different than happened. But my father, on the other hand, grew up in Charleston, West Virginia, and was very, very adamant about making sure that we always stayed connected to those roots. And I remember fondly the trips that we would take in the summertime to go back to West Virginia and see family and people and so on. So it's been somewhat eclectic, but it's been powerful.
Patrice, in the absence of Lacey Ward, I wondered if you'd be willing to talk to the audience about the research you've been conducting here at Virginia involving this university's confrontation with desegregation.
Oh, thank you, Deborah. I came to the University of Virginia in 2005. I am in the Curry School of Education. I'm a teacher educator who loves history, so by no means would I say that I'm a historian, and I love being in the company of people in history, law, politics, and that interdisciplinary element. But my particular dissertation work was a blend of those. I looked at African-American history, education, civil rights, and it looked at... my dissertation was entitled Teaching Democracy, Civic Education in Georgia's African-American Schools from 1930 to 1954. And although he was never named in the dissertation, if you had to put a face on it, my question was, how did Martin Luther King learn to be a citizen in school? How did he learn about justice, civil rights, and equity? And it sprung from being a teacher. I was a middle school teacher for 10 years and seeing students in my class. And I'm very interested today in the civic engagement of youth and what we can do to help youth become much more politically and socially conscious. And as a classroom teacher, I became very frustrated because people seemed to think that youth were disengaged, and I wasn't seeing that at all. So long story short, I decided there had to be an answer in history because I knew the young people that you mentioned in your material were clearly engaged. People who grew up in environments where they were taught were engaged. What happened? And so time took me back, and long story short, I settled in the period of the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and wanted to see how did the teachers teach children to maintain dignity and work for social justice, equity, and civil rights, but they're having to drink out of colored water fountains. So that work was very engaging in documenting that African-American teachers in schools had curriculum, had programs, were teaching, and that it was very active. So from that and coming to Virginia, I initially thought, oh, I could transpose this work. Very good lesson for me to understand that even though we talk about the South monolithically, that there were very distinct differences as well as similarities in terms of how different locales and different states developed that. So in coming to Virginia then and looking to see what would be worth researching, I was very, very fortunate to meet two men, Hank Allen and Jim Bash. They are retired senior professors at the Curry School of Education. And from 1967 to 1981, they were very much involved with something called the Curry Desegregation Center, much longer name. But the federal government sponsored 27 centers in the United States during the period of desegregation. And the University of Virginia was one of the organizations that received funds for a 14-year period to help with the desegregation of schools during this time. And Irvin and I had quite a few conversations because initially it became very challenging because although people reminisced about the center, there was very little documentation. And even here at the university, Irvin's been very helpful in helping me to find the kernels and the nuggets that I can, but it was just somewhat ironic for me for you to have a federally funded center that was in 27 states that existed for 14 years that the University of Virginia received indirect funds and costs for, that when James Bash went to Special Collections a couple years ago to find the records of the center, he was given three folders in one box and told that's all that there was. So I was told as a junior professor, oh, I don't know if you want to do that because that could really take some time and you know you have 3 to 6 years to be here. Why did they say that to me? So in the last year and a half, I've had extensive conversations with Bash and Allen. We have located people who are directly involved with the center, and the best part is we have literally found documents. And so with those documents, we are doing document and data analysis now, first to reconstruct the history of the center, and then secondly to look at its contributions not only to UVA but to the larger community. And the paper that I'm working on now that I hope to present in the spring is specifically looking at the incredible curriculum that was designed specifically for superintendents, administrators, and teachers in helping people learn how to get along in making this systemic transition from desegregation to segregation. Sadly, the work was not as successful as they would have liked for it to have been. And I'm sorry, I can't remember, I think the panelist who said, I think Irvin was the one who said, very often we overlook our history because we're so eager for the success stories, we don't look at the many stepping stones along the way. And I, matter of fact, I talked to Hank Allen just a couple days ago, and I would be remiss if I didn't say the key point that he and Jim want people to know is that you cannot tell the story of the desegregation center without talking about massive resistance. And literally up until the last 12 months, if you said the term massive resistance in Virginia, people still didn't talk about it. And it's literally taken a proclamation from the Charlottesville City Council within the last couple months to say, I'm sorry. It's literally taking within the last 12 months people coming forward, Donald Martin very bravely, personally, sharing his story and life of what's happened. So I'm hoping that with the timing of this, that people will be much more receptive to looking at what the work of the center was, what was successful, why it didn't have the impact that people thought that it should, and what we can learn from that as we truly are grappling with some serious issues in K-12 education in schools today.
I wonder if you could just share with the audience a bit more about Jim Bash's background.
Oh, yes. As was said, this is the history that we speak of is not just about facts and figures. It's about people and people's lives. And the greatest joy I've had in doing this project is to get to know these two incredible people who, I quite frankly, I believe have been grossly overlooked by the university in terms of the contribution that they've made. And although I'm sure there have been other programs and things where they may have been cited, Jim Bash is 85 years old, in well health, still here in Charlottesville, married, grandfather, great-grandfather, very interesting person. He was very much an advocate and a hellraiser. And he came, prior to coming to the University of Virginia, I think what you may be alluding to is he was the principal of the high school in Farmville, Virginia, the year that Farmville decided not to desegregate. And he was one of the lone people who stood up as a white man in an auditorium of people and said, I think we need to consider this and do this. Well, it's an understatement to say he was gently, I guess being white, he was gently run out of town. And after 1 year there, literally left Farmville not knowing what he was going to do and came to UVA, where he eventually received his PhD in education. And then subsequent to that, because he truly has been a lifelong advocate for social justice, found at the time being a white man promoting social justice in that climate was definitely oppositional. And I think it's accurate to say he found a haven or an outlet or a voice for that through Phi Delta Kappa. And through the organization PDK nationally, he was able to publish, and some of the early work that he did in that area was published through PDK, not through UVA, and continued, and it was because of contacts he had through PDK that he learned of the possibility of the center being available at UVA through funding. So he was the person who wrote the original grant for the center and received the funds, and the center was set up in 1967, and he was its first director. However, he only stayed in that capacity for 3 years because, again, in conversations, it was very difficult and very tense for him at that time to want to advocate the policies and the stance that he had in the climate in which he was. He had a family here. He was had community relations and so on. And they took a tremendous amount of heat standing up for what they believed in. So, and I asked Jim, you know, what were things in his life that were pivotal to that? And without going into too much of his personal background, he was born in Indiana, raised by his grandparents, and he went into the military. And he had an opportunity to travel to China at a very young age. And when he witnessed how Chinese workers were treated and saw certain disparities, that was his epiphany in terms of injustice. And the lessons that he learned during that, among other things, were what he carried with him. And so just a fascinating, incredible person. And the true story, there are many stories that I'm trying to unpack, but one specifically is the story of Jim Bash and Hank Allen. Some of you may know Howard Hank Allen, who was very well known in the Danville area. High school basketball coach, state-winning championship teams, and so on. He came to the University of Virginia in the early 70s to study as a facilitator in the institute to take that material and information back to the Danville area. He subsequently became director of the center when he graduated from UVA with his EDD in the early 70s. And to see these two people who were so different, who led completely separate lives, come together here, the work that was done and how they did it, and even though they both retired in the mid-1980s, they both live in Charlottesville. They are fast friends to this day. And their personal friendship and relationship is a true metaphor for the possibilities or the glimmers of hope that we can have when people come together and put aside those differences and understand that we have common values. So, but they're two incredible people. If you ever have a chance to see either one of them or talk to them, please do.
I just wanted to make two comments about the panel. One is that Ronald Walters, who's speaking this afternoon, was one of those Wichita sit-in people. And I don't think he's supposed to talk about that this afternoon, but certainly it's something that has shaped his own amazing career as a political scientist. And I think that both of the panelists raised, all three of you really raised the important issues as a historian of really getting the generation that's the greatest generation, those parents that withstood the lawsuits and desegregation. I know there a few years ago there was a wonderful dissertation at Morgan in history about Farmville and really looking at, in a much more nuanced way, about black parents different, and should they just keep them out? And the way the NAACP other groups were talking, but one of the things that this young woman who was a Park Service, was in the Park Service as she was doing this work, and so had access, really did it as an ethnography and oral history, really getting, you know, beyond the simple story of brave people, yes, but was much more nuanced, and people had a lot of misgivings, and there were a lot of personal sacrifices that are only recently coming to light, because a lot of people missed, you know, not just 1 year, but missed out on a number of years of their education, and we haven't really looked at those losses, the teachers, the actual students who were told to sacrifice their education for this greater good. So I really applaud you, because I think that these are the stories that really need to be put to be captured, especially for those people that are in their 80s and 90s, while we still have them to talk about, to really get that much more nuanced picture, which I think that all three of you really were giving us. So thank you.
I have a question for Professor Pratt about S.W. Tucker. Do you know why he decided to relocate his law practice to Emporia, of all places? As a native of Essex County, you know that's the most southern part of Virginia, where there was really no tradition of black lawyers, at least in the 20th century. Why did he go to Emporia?
I don't know why he went to Emporia. I have no idea.
Remember right, he was working in Richmond and was sort of looking around the place to establish his law firm. And so I think there were, and I'm not certain on this, but I think there were conversations with Hill and Martin, and that they really needed somebody. I mean, they had lawyers in Norfolk, they had lawyers in Roanoke, but they really needed somebody down in that area. And so he located down there.
Hello. I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about how Brown v. Board informs your thinking on current educational policies, things like No Child Left Behind, or programs like Teach for America, for instance, which I was a part of, but I find problematic in ways that kind of recruits from these very elite and typically white institutions to go into urban environments that affect about 94% of the population that they serve are black and Latino students, but I feel like it's problematic the way that they don't actively recruit from schools where black and Latino people actually attend. Thank you.
Excellent question.
Well, I guess I'll take a stab at it. As I alluded to in my comments, I think that there are many, many problems now with public education. I think that black students have been disproportionately locked into low-achieving or non-achieving tracks. And I am completely convinced that this is not appropriate. That's why I said the lawyers thought that once the barriers were down, things would work as they were supposed to. They did not appreciate, and I didn't appreciate until I started doing some research into this, how educational practices can undermine anything that goes on in the classroom. And without an appreciation of that, there really can't be any real progress. I think that in order to make progress, every kid should be exposed to a caring, effective, well-trained teacher. That's the ideal. Teach for America is one response to that, and I know very little about their recruitment practices. As it turns out, I've got a couple of veterans of Teach for America in my family, one of whom remains a teacher to this day, the other of whom lasted for 4 weeks. She left in tears. She said she just could not handle it. because the kids represented such a tough audience, middle schoolers. I applaud the person who said she taught middle school for years. I found that to be a dreadful age. But my point is that I don't know, and I love my kids, believe me, I don't know, you know, very much about how Teaching for America works, but I will say this. It attempts to respond to a need. Perhaps they do need to recruit more broadly. Perhaps they need to do more training of young people before they place them in the classroom. But we're faced, as I understand it, with the situation between having no teacher and a novice teacher who may not be on all fours with the kids in the classrooms that they're trying to control. Given that choice, I think it's better to have somebody who's there, who's able, who's enthusiastic, who may not always connect, than to have miseducation and undereducation perpetuated. That's a short-term solution at best. Over the long haul, we need to have the same kind of dedicated teachers that taught me when I was growing up. And I think, by and large, taught my kids. My biggest problem with those who taught my kids is that they lacked diversity. But they were competent, they were dedicated, and by and large, I think that there's a couple of exceptions. I would be entirely comfortable seeing my kids go through that same sequence again.
As a career educator and a parent, I have some very grave concerns. And to personalize it, if you allow me, I remember the decisions that my husband and I went through in trying to educate our children in Atlanta, Georgia, in the early 80s, where I'm from as most recently. And it was literally navigating our children through schooling. And you would think Atlanta, Georgia clearly would have many more educational options, opportunities. It would be more varied. So I can look at this intellectually and I can look at it as a parent. Intellectually, I believe that there's certain things that should occur. But personally, as a parent, I was willing to do whatever I had to do in whatever way I needed to make sure that our kids got an education. So we did everything from Christian to Afrocentric to single sex to public. I mean, we literally did it all. And I think my biggest frustration over the last couple years has been he is now recently married with a child, a grandchild. They are beginning to ask themselves the same questions about education for their African-American son that we asked about him. Something is wrong with that. Something is inherently wrong with that. And while we can point to the glimmers of hope and examples where many things have gone well, until the least of these have the benefits and opportunities that others have, we still have a lot of work to do. That said, I can think of my dad who would say, anybody who says separate but equal was never separate. And so by no means, I mean, and there are different cadres now in education. You have some of the counter arguments now, people who are saying Brown didn't work, we need to go back to segregated schools. You're hearing that a lot in certain elements. We look at charter schools, we look at religious schools, we look at many different types of things that are occurring. There's a lot on the table right now, and I would say that if there was ever a time when people really need to be involved in education and advocate, it's now. Because where in the Deweyan tradition, schools locally were managed from the bottom up, and local communities were very involved. If you really look at the way K-12 education is structured today, it is very top down. It is very much dictated by business and industry. It's very much dictated by a philanthropy, the way many of our schools were in the 20s, where people who have large sums of money create grants and so on to dictate how work is done. So right now, it's really in the midst of tremendous change. That being said, this could provide some tremendous opportunities in the shift for people to do things. But I guess at the end of the day, I wouldn't be where I am in the Curry School teaching K-6 pre-service teachers how to teach social studies in our schools if I didn't believe that that was a way that I couldn't make a contribution to help promote diversity, social justice, and equity, where 95% of the students who I teach are white.
You know, the other issue is that, you know, those of us who have good eyes are not watching. And when we talk about closing schools here in Charlottesville, that mentality still exists. You know, when there's a county school that has 25 principals and only one black, we're not watching close enough. So those of us who have good eyes need to watch a little bit more and stop being silent right here in this town where they close the schools.
question for each member of the panel, if you're willing to address it. The panel is really focused on legal battles against segregated schools, and each of you have talked a little personally, I think, about your own experiences. And each of you has also had a period of time at the University of Virginia. So I'd be really interested, if you're willing to go there, to talk about how your own educational experiences, either in segregated or integrated schools, has prepared you or not for your time at a university that's had a very, very problematic racial past.
Let me start by thinking about my own educational experience. And there have been many discussions and books written about what education was like for black children pre-Brown, post-Brown, what long-term impact has Brown decision had, what have been the benefits of it. I think one of the things that really stuck out for me in a very glaring way was the kind of education that I received when I was in an all-black environment. And by that I mean, when we were in the second, third, fourth grade, there was a very heavy emphasis on African-American history and culture in my schools. By the time I was in third, fourth grade, I was reciting poetry by County Cullen and Paul Lawrence Dunbar. I knew who Claude McKay was. All of us did, because it was taught, it was emphasized. And we did this, it was really integrated into our curriculum. We knew about slavery and what the experience had been on black peoples in this country. Again, it was part of our curriculum. When the schools integrated in 1970-71, we had the first class I had. My first white teacher was a woman who had a notorious reputation at the white school for being tough, no nonsense. She was, very rigid. And the students, the white students, told us about it. They were in fear of her. And so we had our first class. She was Virginia history. And she was true to form. But I noticed that when we got to the section in the textbook that was, I think it was titled, that chapter, American Negro Slavery, she came to class that morning. She seemed a little bit nervous, and she said, the experience of slavery in this country was so shameful and so disgraceful that I don't think I want to discuss it. So with, that went that chapter. The point being that, for the rest of that year, seventh grade, and for the rest of my high school experience, really the administration almost tiptoed around the issue of race. So I didn't get any more black history from seventh grade on, not in school. It wasn't until I went off to college that I began to once again sort of immerse myself in it. But that was one of the things that we lost, that emphasis on our history, because I think white administrators and black administrators as well were afraid that if we discuss this too much, that there will be tensions, there will be anxiety, there will be anger, and who knows what that will lead to inevitably. So there was a reluctance to discuss it. And in related to the last question about teaching, I work in Atlanta with Clayton County. Worked with them for the past several years and teaching American history grants. And I guess there was a lot about teaching in public school that I really didn't know, because I'm thinking that that high school, middle school teachers have the same kind of flexibility and latitude in their classrooms that I have in mine. And so the grant that we got was the transformation of America with a special emphasis on civil rights history from 1945 to 2000. And so here I'm trying to help public school teachers learn civil rights history so that they can go back and teach it into into their students, not realizing that they are laboring under all kinds of constraints. They don't really have enough. And then they are telling me, well, we can only devote so many minutes a day to this. And this all came as quite a shock to me, that, you know, there is so much pressure being placed on teachers now to teach the test, I guess, as opposed to really teaching the subject. And I see that as, that's a major challenge. But, you know, my teachers didn't labor under those kinds of constraints. And I think that's been for the worse, unfortunately. Oh, my first couple of years here were hell. When I came in 1980, because I was the only African American in the program for those years, and that was the way it was. And there were days in the first couple of years where I thought that I probably would not stay here. But Paul Gaston, who was my major professor, was my salvation, as was the Carter G. Woodson Institute. It was my good fortune to come here at the same time that Armistead Robinson had been recruited from UCLA to organize the Carter Woodson Institute. And so Paul and Armistead became my mentors. And although I was working on a PhD in history, most of the time I had a mailbox in history that I checked once a month, but I never went to the district department. Other than to take my classes, I spent all of my time at the Carter Woodson Institute, and that was my salvation. But for that, I would not have survived, because the environment here was just not welcoming. I mean, I had been admitted, but being admitted isn't being welcomed. They're two totally different things. And I experienced that in classrooms, in experiences with several professors. Most of my experiences here were positive, I'm glad to say, but not all of them were. And there were clearly some who had their own agenda. There were some who were still fighting the Civil War, some who didn't, but who had not got the word that the North had really won. And so that was some of that.
Some of them are still here.
That was some of that. And it wasn't just on the part of faculty, but also some of my classmates. You know, there was one in particular who walked around and very proudly with his belt buckle, CSA, as in Confederate States of America. I mean, he was very proud of it. And this is what greeted me when I came to this place in 1980. But as I said, for Paul Gaston and Armistead Robinson and others who came later, Waldo Martin, who is now at Berkeley, these folk came. They came at a time, just in time, to save me. Because had they not been here, I would have been long gone.
Well, I'm going to direct my remarks primarily to my experience here at UVA. I will say that educationally, I share the experience which has already been described by Professor Grimes and by Professor Pratt. I think it's, for whatever it's worth, part of my formative years in public education were overseen quite directly by my parents. My mother was one of my high school teachers. It was an interesting experience. In class, I'd raise my hand when I wanted her attention, and she would point. My father was my principal, and my father was really quite imaginative. This was in a segregated high school in South Carolina, and even though I realized that tracking is very much a matter of debate, he effectively tracked the high school. Now, this did not result in one black kid in advanced classes, so to speak. We were all black. But it meant that he had a cadre of black kids who were prepared to pursue college work very effectively throughout South Carolina and in other schools that, in which they happened to matriculate. But my point is that I felt well prepared educationally all along the line. And candidly, schoolwork was... I never thought of it as a challenge. It just came easily to me. Now, one of the things we haven't talked about is the achievement gap and the link between social pressure and the aspiration to achieve. I sort of took it for granted that I could achieve, but I recognized in retrospect that it made me a little bit different So in some ways, I've always been kind of an outsider. And even now, I think of myself as an outsider. And I think that experience quite candidly prepared me for UVA. Ultimately, I realized that I wind up where I am not because I did exceptional work at Fisk or exceptional work at Howard, but because I got a master's in law at Harvard. And that gave me a stamp of approval. That then made me, you know, a feasible candidate for other things. And before I came to Virginia, I actually taught for a period of time at Florida State. Now, of course, you know, in the manner of the world, there were people who took shots at my having gone to Harvard. On one occasion, an attorney that I knew in Florida said, "Well, Mildred," he said, "you went to Harvard, but you got there under an affirmative action quota." I said, "Buddy, you didn't get there at all, not even under a redneck quota." That took care of that. But my point is that, you know, frankly, I'm in a tough profession. It's heavily male, it's heavily white, it's heavily upper middle class to upper class. Further, the motto of the profession, said kind of tongue in cheek, but I think there's a lot of truth in it, is never let them see you bleed. And so, you know, it's not an environment that tends to be particularly supportive. As a matter of fact, your best measure of how well you've done something is the extent to which you're ignored for having done it. UVA, a top 10 law school, has all of those attributes. Now, there are people there who are very friendly and who are very supportive, but it is also very much a collection of entrepreneurs. And everybody, my predominantly male colleagues, are trying the best they can to get ahead. I've spent many years as the sole black woman on the faculty. In recent years, within the last 4 years, I think, we've added two black women, both tenured, happily, so they don't have to worry about moving on to other places. But the fact of the matter is, it has been kind of a lonely existence. But I don't complain about it. It's what I chose. And the fact of the matter is, I enjoy doing what I do in the classroom. In terms of my research, my publications, my education at Howard clearly influences what I do. Houston's view, of course, was that if you aren't a social engineer as an attorney, then you're a parasite on society. And in the kind of work that I've attempted to do, I've tried to remember my obligation to reflect to the best of my ability, public interest, to pay attention to general welfare and to remain true to that. So I don't crunch numbers, even though I teach tax courses and I love what I do, because I think if you follow the money, you know so much about where power lies. So I do that for that reason, but at the same time, I try to look at public finance to question ways in which the financial burdens of an organized society are born. And in that way, I try to be true to what Houston would have wished. But the fact of the matter is that I realize that some of my ability to gain a platform or to gain the ear of others flows from the fact that I am at UVA, and I accept that.
Were you going to add something? I have a question. No,
I'm done.
I was just very briefly. Well, first of all, you know that commercial on TV with the cell phones when the man's standing there and it's like, you know, he's not by himself. There are about 100 other people behind him with his network. I am just so blessed that I stand on strong shoulders. And there are so many, many people who have helped me sit in this seat today. People like Mildred, people like Deborah McDowell, some of you in the audience who I know. They have helped within the UVA community. I'm very proud to say I feel I was very prepared with my doctoral program at Emory University, and I think of people like Jacqueline Jordan Irvine, Vanessa Siddle Walker. I better not start naming names because then, you know, you get into trouble. But I think that helped tremendously. So when I came to UVA in 2005, I felt that I was equipped to be here. That said, trying to find your place, I think as a junior faculty person right now, clearly I'm navigating certain things. But I will say what really drew me to Virginia is that the research is just so rich. And there's so much to be done. And as the lady said in the back, I mean, what I'm finding and what I'm uncovering, I could be here for a lifetime and never scratch the surface of the stories that need to be told, the things that need to be empirically documented. And what motivates me literally every week is that, for example, Hank Allen is 88. He just had his 88th birthday. Jim Bash is 85. We're losing people. They're leaving us. And if we don't really make an effort to to capture these sorts of things. I also have to give a quick plug to ASALA, the Association of African American Life and History, an organization that I've affiliated with 3 years ago through a colleague at University of Georgia. Tremendous support for the kind of work I do and having scholars come together to do that. And then the third thing I think that motivates me is just the outreach, that through the Teaching American History grant program, I've had an opportunity in the last 4 years to go to almost every corner of the state and work with teachers, Southwest Virginia, South Boston, North Virginia, and so on. And the need is just so great for teachers who really want to be taught and taught well and to learn how to navigate these tensions and challenges that we have in this No Child Left Behind era. So in really focusing on the work and wonderful relationships that have come from that, that has helped me, I think, somewhat to navigate through some of this. And then we'll see when I get on the other side of the fence, where other things may lead. But there definitely have been challenges, but I think I'm a woman on a mission. And we all have different tools in using that mission, and I think mine right now is to really do good quality research and write, and then other things will come along with that.
Bob, I have a question of you. The question comes from an essay of yours that I read a while ago on Loving versus Virginia. You talked about the NAACP's work in these public arenas concerning education, labor, etc. But that particular essay addressed the NAACP's role, however minimal, in that case. So we know that the NAACP began as an organization that was a cross-racial alliance and that saw social justice as intimately connected to or being implementable through this interracial coalition. So trying to talk about questions of affect and these interior matters and who people love, who they don't love, you can't get at. But we can get at the NAACP's efforts to navigate into those murky waters as well.
Yes. It was interesting because when Mildred Loving, and I should add for those of you who don't know, I've done some stuff on the Loving versus Virginia case, working on something else now. The Lovings were my neighbors in Essex County when I was growing up in the early 60s. Richard Loving was a white man. Mildred Jeter was his black wife, part black, part Native American. And they had gotten married in 1958. They went to Washington, D.C. to be married because in Virginia at the time there were what they called anti-miscegenation statutes that prohibited interracial marriage. And so they went to D.C. to get married in 1958, but they were unaware of the part of Virginia's anti-miscegenation statute which said that not only can you not be married in Virginia, but you cannot attempt to circumvent the law by going to some other place where interracial marriages are legal and then get married and then return to Virginia to live as husband and wife. When they came back to the state, they were arrested. They were sentenced to either 1 year in jail or they had to go in exile and not return to the state for 25 years. Rather than face jail time, they chose the latter, and so they went to D.C. where they lived for several years, and on the weekends, they were in Caroline County. Caroline is adjacent to Essex, where I grew up. Mildred's sister, Garnet, and her husband, Raymond Hill, rented a room from a boarding house that my great uncle owned, and on the weekends, they would, now under the terms of the law, of the banishment, both Richard and Mildred were allowed to come back to Virginia to visit their family and relatives and friends, but they could not travel together as husband and wife, nor could they be caught in the state at the same time. Those were the stipulations. So they would come to Virginia. Mildred would sometimes arrive first with the three children. And sometime a little later on that night or maybe the next night, we would see Richard's car come in from the other direction. He would go behind the house. So he had time to visit, but it was after dark, so to speak. That was trying to avoid detection from the authorities. But I knew the family well. I grew up, I played with the children, especially the oldest son, Sidney, who is a year older than I am. Mildred Lovin first got interested in, and decided that she was going to challenge this. She had been talking to some, had been told to contact the NAACP. She eventually contacted the ACLU. Well, she contacted Robert Kennedy, and she sent a letter to him, who steered her toward the ACLU. Now, the ACLU and the NAACP had some very interesting discussions about this particular case, because I think Mildred's thinking was that this was something the NAACP would get involved in. The NAACP did work in this case very much behind the scenes, but I found some interesting correspondence from Roy Wilkins, who said that, you know, there are some Southern white folk who have been saying that what we all wanted all along was to get into white women's beds. So for obvious reasons, we don't want to take the lead on this case. So the ACLU and the NAACP had a very, very interesting relationship in that the ACLU actually decided to push forward and to take the lead role in that case, with the NAACP assisting sort of in the shadows, behind the scenes, and of course, as you know, would eventually file a friend of the court brief in support of it. But it was sort of interesting for me to see this correspondence that said the NAACP wanted sort of to let somebody else take the lead on this one.
Mm-hmm. And I believe our time is now. So thank you.
Thank you very much.